just basically Central Iowa recreational league for the gay and lesbian communities. We've been around for a couple of years now. I see a couple of faces I know that come in and out. We're pretty much year round doing some sort of event. Right now we have a lot of members who just come in the wintertime and do volleyball, or come out at fall and do softball or something. So we have a Facebook page, we have a website, we have a sign up over there as well. If you want to become a part of the email club, let me know and tell me if you have any questions. But we'd love to see more of you out there and just really kind of help with sort of the wellness of the communities.
Very good. Welcome. Others? All right. Those of you who are regulars, if you'll look around for some unfamiliar faces, and there are two or three others who are, be sure and make them feel welcome so that they will participate again at a future meeting. Let's see. The book exchange is in the foyer. There are books as well as videos there that are there for the taking, and you may borrow those for as long as you want. And if you have books or videos or whatever that you would like to share, why, bring them and leave them on the table. And I want to thank Scott Cookneo, my partner, for coordinating the book exchange. I invite you to visit our website, ffbciowa.org. It has been in the process of updating and enhanced, and there are a lot of resources identified there. In addition, if you miss a meeting or you want to rehear what one of our speakers has said, we do audio record our speakers, and those then are put on the website as a link. You can go there and hear a speaker that maybe you missed in the past or want to hear again. If you look around the room and you notice that someone who ought to be here isn't, you can put their name and contact information on a sheet at the registration desk, and we will extend a personal invitation to them to participate in the future. We have a number of announcements. First thing I wanted to mention was the death of a longtime FFBC member, Larry Hoke. If you look around, you'll see he's not here, and his partner David is not here either. I did reach out to David and encourage him to come to the meeting this morning just so he could be surrounded by some supportive friends, but he didn't feel up to it. He said he'd plan to be here next month. So when he shows up, if you'll show him some support and express your condolences, I think he would appreciate that. Next thing was mentioned by Michael Ward is the book that he has written, The Sea is Quiet Tonight. He's going to be doing a book reading this evening at 6:30 at Beaverdale Books. So if you would be interested in that, that's the time and the location. Next Wednesday, the 9th, is our regular board meeting. If there are those members who are interested in attending the FFBC board meeting, it'll be next Wednesday evening at 6:15 at Scott and my home. Get in touch with either of us or any board member for directions. The newsletter copy is due on the 14th. That's a week from next Monday. So if you have something that is on your mind or that you've had an experience that you'd like to share, get your article to me by that deadline, and we'll get it into the newsletter, and we welcome any inputs that you might have. All of the pieces that are in the newsletter essentially are written by people who are in one way or another affiliated with FFBC. I encourage you to take a look at some of the Prime Timer activities. They have lots of activities. So if you are wanting to have more interactions in a gay, predominantly male environment, Prime Timers offers you that opportunity in a wide variety of activities. If you haven't finished up with having an early morning breakfast, they have another one on the 7th of November. They have cocktails on Wednesday the 9th. They have Veterans Day lunch on November the 11th. They have a Domino's RSVP event on the 11th. On the 15th, they have a walk and talk, and on and on and on. So there are a lot of activities. They are also available on the web, and you can check out their activities there. On November the 12th, is the Des Moines Gay Men's Chorus Eat, Sing, Drink, and Sing event. It is going to be at Whitmer House, 2000 Grand Avenue. The tickets are $75. It's at 7 o'clock in the evening. That same day, on the 12th, is the ACLU of Iowa Bill of Rights brunch from 10:30 to 12:30. We have a raffle going, and if you haven't signed up, we have a raffle going for free tickets to the ACLU Bill of Rights brunch, as well as the event for the project. And if you want to sign up, you can do that, and we'll have a little drawing here at the end of the meeting to give those tickets away. The FFBC is co-sponsoring both of those events. We have been working on putting together 30 of us who would pledge at least $100 for a David Hurd Memorial Scholarship. And we're drawing close to that objective. His last gift before he died was $3,000 for a scholarship. And we need one more person who will pledge at least $100 to put us over that mark and be able to award a scholarship in his honor next spring. So if there's one among you who would be willing to pledge $100, that'll give us the $3,000 that we need to put us over that mark. Finally, we've been... Yes?
Pledging.
Yes. Pardon? Oh, there's my one?
Yes.
All right. We are now... It's the one that goes over that 3,000 mark that gets all the accolades and the applause and everything, and all those people whose shoulders that he is standing on get nothing. But thank you to all 30 who chose to participate in that. And then, speaking of that, giving, we've been trying to encourage people to think about legacy gifts that might help fund our scholarships long into the future. And I can tell you that in just the last... 2 or 3 weeks, we have had two people, one who included the FFBC in their will, so I don't want them to die anytime soon, but they will eventually die, and that then will benefit the FFBC long into the future. We have had one other member who has made a change in the beneficiary designations of their life insurance to include the FFBC. So as that thought sort of sinks in and is nurtured and you think about it, that kind of a legacy gift would be very much appreciated by the group. And make sure I covered. Yes. With that, I will turn to Alan van der Linden, who is going to introduce our speaker of the morning. Alan.
Thank you. Maria Philippone is a physician, a co-founder of the Des Moines Young Artist Theater, and co-owner of Noche, Des Moines' premier jazz club. She's a mother of three girls and is currently pursuing a lifelong dream of learning Arabic at Drake University. Creating the Live Jazz Club is the latest project Maria and her husband Bob have undertaken. And I'm sure if you want to ask her more about that, she would be glad to talk about it. In January 2016, she traveled to the Middle East as part of a medical delegation to Gaza. Due to the findings of the U.S. study released by the United Nations last year, which stated things, if things remain unchanged, Gaza will be uninhabitable by 2020. She finds, because of this, she finds special urgency to share her story in order to stop the elimination of 2 million people. Maria has created a slideshow documentation of her experiences in the West Bank and Gaza. This past summer, I attended one of the many presentations that she made on the topic and found the information most compelling. because that presentation included an individual representing the organization Jewish Voices for Peace, I became aware that the urgency of the issue is not only a concern of the Palestinian people, but of many other supporting individuals and organizations. Marie, welcome to First Friday Breakfast Club.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you, everybody, for having me here today. I'm very honored to be here and share my story about Gaza. In fact, 24 hours from now, I'll be on a plane to go back to Gaza. Like you said, I traveled to Gaza, and I have a really short time to talk, so I'm going to talk really fast. If you want me to get into it later in the question and answer period, I'll tell you why or how I got involved with this, but for now, let's go forward. This is a map of the Middle East. When I first made this PowerPoint, I made it for my daughter's 7th grade Global Studies classes at Brody, and they had just studied this whole area, especially Israel-Palestine. So I got this up to show them that this is these boundaries are actually a result of Western colonialism from the 1800s and 1900s, not necessarily taking into account the indigenous people there. Most of it was colonized by France and Britain, some Spain, and then, of course, a little bit the U.S., mainly Israel. When I talk about this, I'm not saying Israel doesn't have a right to exist. I'm just sharing my experience and a different narrative to this whole conflict in that part of the world, because it's not heard in this country. In 1948, the founding of Israel for Zionists was a land without a people for a people without a land. It's a story of celebration. The narrative, however, of the indigenous people in Palestine they call it their Nakba, which means catastrophe in Arabic, because over 750,000 Palestinians were displaced from their homes, thousands were murdered and massacred, bodies were stuffed in wells of women and children in different villages. It's a story of catastrophe. Thousands more were exiled to different refugee camps in neighboring countries, including in Gaza and the West Bank, where many of their descendants remain today. So there's just another side, another narrative that we don't often listen to in this country. This is a map of various stages of Palestine, Israel, through the decades. This is 1947, before the founding of the State of Israel. This is after the partition plan, and then after the 1948 colonization, and then now this is what it looks like. This is pre-1967 Six-Day War. This is now what it looks like, and in fact, this is a few years old, this map. There's even less green here. If you don't know your geography, this is Gaza right here. There's two sets of rules in Israel-Palestine. If you are Israeli, you are ruled under civil law. If you are Palestinian, you are ruled under military law. And easiest ways to see this is to look at a map of the road system. If you're Israeli, you have a yellow license plate, and you can drive on all of the roads except the roads in Gaza. If you're a Palestinian, you have a white license plate, and you can only drive on the white roads, on the red roads with restrictions, and you cannot drive on the yellow roads. You can see how that cuts people off from work, from their homes, from their land, from just everyday travel. A great example of this was when we arrived in January of this year. Zuckby, a 57-year-old Christian Palestinian living in Bethlehem, he heads the WEAM Conflict Resolution Center, who was our sponsor in Bethlehem. He had not had permission to leave Bethlehem since 1998. And he had permission because of the Christian holiday, Christmas, and such after that, and he rode on the bus to Tel Aviv to pick us up at Ben Gurion, and he was shocked at how much development had happened. I can't imagine anybody in this country not being able to drive a 30-minute drive away from their house. not being allowed. There's a 24-foot-tall apartheid wall, which is twice the height of the Berlin Wall, covered with barbed wire with armed soldiers all throughout Israel-Palestine, and especially in Gaza. And you can see they resist. This artwork has become the international depiction of this conflict. It was done by a London artist named Banksy. The Gaza Strip is a 24-mile-long stretch of land that's 4 to 7 miles wide. Actually, on my birthday this year, October 11th, the 2 millionth resident was born in Gaza, so now it's 2 million people. To compare it to the United States, our smallest state is Rhode Island. Rhode Island is 8.7 times larger, with just over 1 million people. Over the past three wars on Gaza, Israel has intentionally damaged and destroyed infrastructure, which according to the UN is collective punishment and against international law. There's no airport, no power plant, no cinema, no economy, no freedom of movement. There's nothing but misery there. Israel controls 100% of everything into Gaza, including water and electricity. Most Gazans get only 4 hours of electricity a day. 96% of the water is not fit for human consumption. The international community calls Gaza the world's largest open-air prison. I disagree with that. After being there, prisoners in prison get health care, food, and water. Most Gazans don't get that. Also, it's on the Mediterranean Sea, and it's actually beautiful here, absolutely beautiful. And I saw, as you'll see in my slides, a picture of the seaside. International waters begin at 20 nautical miles offshore of any country. So theoretically or legally, I don't know, they should be able to go further than what they can go. But Israel shoots at or arrests fishermen, Gaza fishermen, if they go more than 6 nautical miles offshore. And this is really significant because it's really overfished up until 6 nautical miles, and that is contributing to starvation. The people who had gone there before to Gaza said, oh, after the 2014 war, they said the same thing, two things in common. Oh, you've done so much cleanup after the 2014 war, and I thought, wow, that's cleaned up, as you'll see. And then the other thing they said was they noticed there's no hope. In prior generations, Palestinians had faith that their hope, their suffering would lead to change for their descendants, but now they have no hope. The only entrance into Gaza is through Israel, is through Erez, Israel. Occasionally the Rafah border at Egypt gets open, but that's not anything reliable. As you can see, that's the entrance. I took that picture, 24-foot tall concrete wall. You have to go through, when you enter Erez, you go through, you enter this huge building and it looks empty and vacant, and there's eyes, however, watching you everywhere. And you have to go through a series of turnstiles and cages to get in, and you get separated from your people you're traveling with, you get separated from your luggage, and it's very kind of creepy. There's a 1 kilometer long caged walk you have to take to get to the Gaza side. Israel calls this the kill zone. They admit that this land belongs to Gaza. However, it constitutes over 30% of the most fertile farmland. However, Gazans are unable to use it because Israel kills anybody that enters it, saying it's a security threat. And as we were crossing, we heard about a dozen gunshots, and found out later two men went up to the edge of the kill zone and threw rocks into it and were killed by IDF as we were crossing, as like a form of resistance. Here's more of the wall. And then when you're walking through this cage, on the left is the really nice farmland, the kill zone. On the right, it's barren. But why is that not the kill zone? Palestinians are allowed to go and scavenge for whatever there. This is northeastern Gaza as we entered. After the 2009 offensive on Gaza, Italian teams found depleted uranium in Israeli missile craters. Israel later admitted to using white phosphorus in that attack, but they never admitted to using uranium, depleted uranium. Since then, they destroyed all labs in Gaza, so there's no way to see what the Gazans are exposed to now. There are alarmingly high rates of breast and brain cancers among young people. There's no way to assess this epidemiologically, as there's no public health because there's no infrastructure. In 2014, 30,000 bombs were dropped on Gaza by Israel. Of those, 10,000 remain unexploded. Of those that were unexploded, 3,000, only 3,000 have been found. Exactly 1 month after I returned, a 5-year-old boy in Jabalia, which is the most densely populated refugee camp in the world, in northern Gaza, was killed when unexploded ordnance went off and killed him and injured his 6-year-old brother just playing in the street. It's incredibly, if you've never seen a refugee camp, it's incredible, incredible poverty. A 7-year-old child in Gaza has already lived through 3 wars. This picture is Islamic University. They're still, Israel's not allowing reconstruction materials in, saying that Hamas is using them for weapons or to build tunnels or whatever. However, they're not allowed to even like repair windows. This is in northeastern Gaza, and you can see that's a very dangerous area because IDF just randomly shoots in there because it's at the border, as is southern Gaza. We got a special tour of the Rafah-Egypt border. It's been closed since 2013. There were around 950 tunnels connecting Gaza to Egypt and Gaza to Israel. And these tunnels, yes, weapons were smuggled in, but why do they not have a right to have a military or defend themselves? But also, these tunnels are what made an economy possible in Gaza. They supplied medicine, food, electronics, connected families, supplied clothing, toys, everything you can imagine that's involved in an economy. And now, with your dollars, U.S. tax dollars, we are blowing up the tunnels or flooding them with seawater. This is significant because Rafah is now the breadbasket of Gaza, so they're unable to grow food. And also, the last freshwater aquifer is located there, and it's beyond repair as of the end of this year. It's being flooded with salt water, so pretty soon they will have no water. There's pictures of the craters. I stopped counting at 25 or so. There's hundreds of craters. And then this is a picture of a crack that evolved while we were there. It wasn't there when we came. And that's the Egypt-Rafah border. This is a Hamas outpost at the Egypt-Rafah border. There you go. When you ask for security or police in Gaza, your only option is Hamas. And we had to have some security when we toured northeastern Gaza. And it's funny because all the Gazans laugh and they say, well, we can't really call them military. Well, because they're not that sophisticated. What we're doing is they're primitive compared to Israeli capabilities. When you talk about this issue, I want to put it into context. You're comparing the fourth most powerful military in the world with nuclear weapons, Israel, against a mostly unarmed civilian population, the Palestinians, who are living under occupation. And I'm referring to the West Bank there too. And Gaza is living under siege. The siege is now going on its 9th year. As you drive south to Rafah, you see this huge sewage outlet that was created by Israel when they occupied Gaza in early 2000s. And there's this pipe that they, when it rains, raw human untreated sewage floods Gaza, and Israel opens this pipe and sends untreated human sewage into the Mediterranean. Our sponsor in Gaza was an organization called Gaza Community Mental Health Program. It's an NGO aimed at providing high-quality mental health care services to the people of Gaza. There's a term, they don't like to use the term PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, because there's nothing post about the trauma and that they're undergoing. The trauma's ongoing. Someone coined the term Gaza syndrome, which is more accurate. What they did after the 2014 war was they took children to their very own neighborhoods, and the children dug through the rubble and got their very own toys and made art. This one is especially striking, at least to me, because you probably can't see it from there, but this girl, she put sad faces on the sun and the tree and the flowers. This is a Fanus Ramadan, which means a lantern. Fanus means lantern, and it's a toy kids get during the month of Ramadan because they fast all day, and then when the sun goes down, they break the fast with a family and a feast and everything, and the kids get toys. It's like Christmas for a month. And so they light the darkness with these lanterns, and this child found her Fanus. And I just have pictures. This is my friend Allah's daughter, Maria. She named her after me. No, I'm kidding. But these children, they're just lovely. Everybody in Gaza is so happy to see Americans. They're cut off from the rest of the world, and all they want to do is be a part of it. Everywhere I went, people said, "Where are you from? What are you doing here?" And I would explain, and they said, "What do you think of Gaza?" And I said, "I love Gaza. It's beautiful. I love you. I love these people." And they would say, "It's ugly." Why? Huh? So during the 2014 war on Gaza, if you remember those, there were four boys. They were brothers and cousins, Abu Bakr. They were playing soccer on the beach in the middle of the day, in the middle of the week, and there were many international news crews having tea inside this restaurant. It's a Dira restaurant. In fact, one MSNBC reporter had just been kicking the soccer ball around with these boys, walked away to go have his tea, and the boys were killed by Israel playing on the beach because they were a threat. Islamic University, they still can't repair windows, and that gets really cold in the winter. The only schools in Gaza are... well, there are a couple private schools, but most of the schools are... run by the United Nations. I went to different women's clinics and mental health clinics and stuff and resource centers for people. And these stories these women told me in front of their children were heartbreaking. One woman told me of how she'd been begging a butcher for scraps to feed her family, her seven kids, three of whom are disabled, and her husband, who has been disabled since the last war. She would get the intestines and scraps from the butcher, fry them with bread, and feed her family. And now four of her children and her husband are in kidney failure from E. coli. Another woman told me how three times she tried to commit suicide, and each time one of her children stopped her. And she described each suicide attempt in detail to me. Another woman said, "In the U.S., you have rights for humans. Even animals have rights. Why can't we have those rights? We're human." And that's just a few of the stories. I promised them I'd bring their stories back when I came. If any of you know, that's Noam Chomsky. He received an honorary degree from Islamic University in Gaza in, I think, 2012 or 11, because he's been such an avid, outspoken supporter of Palestinian rights. There are lots, and he came to his views on the situation while living on a kibbutz in Israel in the 1970s. There are a lot of beautiful Jewish voices who speak out for Palestinian rights and against the occupation. I'll share some with you later. That's Dr. Yasser Jamia. He's our the head of the GCMHP, a psychiatrist. And this is just showing you, this is northeastern Gaza, and that's the really beautiful manicured fields of Israel just over the way. That's our organizer, Jerry Haynes. Survivor of the war. We got to tour northeastern Gaza on Friday because that's the holy day. That's like our Sunday. And so we didn't have to work. And we almost didn't go because Israel was amassing artillery and tanks at the border as if they were going to invade. And we all voted and said, okay, we'll go, but we got security. Well, our security was Hamas. And they're just like really short men in suits with a gun taking selfies. Anyways, it was very dangerous, but we toured it. There's children scavenging through these piles of rubble and these missile craters for anything they can sell or eat, and they're barefoot often. And who knows, besides the threat of another attack, the highest danger to Gazans right now is toxicity, just because of the weapons and the things they've been exposed to. This is Shujaiya, the most densely populated, one of the most densely populated neighborhoods in Gaza. And like when I gave the example of Rhode Island before, that should help you put it into context exactly how densely populated this small area is. But you can see this was in the 2014 war. Israel invaded not only from the sea and the sky, but also on land through tanks. And this was where they flattened quite a bit of this neighborhood. There's also in northeastern Gaza, where El Waifa Rehabilitative Hospital stood. It's a hospital Israel said told people to evacuate because they were going to bomb it, because there were weapons there. So they evacuated and they did bomb it, but no weapons were found. I mean, people are literally living right on top of each other. It's so densely populated. Why I do this? I do this because a UN report in 2015 came out and said if things don't change in Gaza, if the siege is not lifted, Gaza will be uninhabitable by 2020. I'm not okay with 2 million people being annihilated. And the thing is, if we speak up and say no more, it will end really rather quickly, because we give $10 million a day in military aid to Israel. I'm not saying we shouldn't give aid. I'm saying we need to attach conditions to that. The current situation is certainly not sustainable for my Palestinian brothers and sisters, and neither is it sustainable for my Israeli brothers and sisters. And we all need to stop this, and we can do it. We have the power here in the U.S. because we are the most powerful nation in the world, and we are the reason that things continue on as they are. And that's a beautiful sunset over Gaza. So I love that picture. I have more. I can talk about Bethlehem, but have I gone far enough?
Yeah, you
can do Q&A. I can do, okay. We'll leave it at Gaza. Talk about the West Bank next time. Any questions? Thanks for having me.
How will this end? Well, how should this end, and how do you think it will end?
I think that a two-state solution is not viable because it would continue to lead to two separate sets of laws, continue to be an apartheid sort of state. I think that we in the West need to close our mouths and open our ears and get people from that area to talk, more Palestinians. And in fact, 2 weeks ago, I was at a conference in Washington, D.C., U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, and every single speaker at the conference was Palestinian in some way or another, and they had so much to offer. We don't hear the Palestinian voices. We need to hear that. Every Palestinian I asked, I said, what is the solution? What do you think the solution is? They said, one state. We don't care what you call it. Call it Israel. Just give me the same rights. So I'm not pretending to know the answer. I'm just putting this to you. Yes?
And the security that was assigned to you, were they armed?
Yeah, with a handgun.
Like a handgun.
Yeah, it was. My father is from Colombia, South America, and the police there are much scarier because they're in military garb. I mean, this was incredible. It was just. I'm not saying Hamas is good. I'm not getting into that. I'm just saying that's who they have to offer them security. And from what I saw, they are far less sophisticated in capabilities than Israel or U.S. or something. So.
Are there others such as yourself going around talking about this and giving this different narrative?
Not that I know of. I don't know. I went with Dr. David Drake. He went on our trip, too. I went with an organization called Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility out of Washington State, because there's a group of people who go there who go to Gaza often, who are live in Washington, who organize this trip.
So, Gaza, it sounds basically like it's independent, but not. What are the hurdles to either consolidating Gaza Strip into Israel, or where's the pathway to peace?
The pathway to peace. I'm going to get to the end here. I'm leaving with you some materials that. You can make copies of if you like, because I'm not going to reach. But what you can do in the UN report on the effects of the blockade. I think that once we start honestly talking about this as what it is, occupation, then we can and honestly acknowledge the history the Palestinians have suffered, their Nakba, and what actually happened to them. That's, I think, the first step. But I'm no expert. I'm no expert.
I've been with a group at church working on a book and reading it called Collapse. Are you familiar with that book?
No.
It really talks about how in history many different communities and societies have collapsed and why they collapsed. And you just outlined this morning all five issues of why something collapses, including unfriendly neighbors, unable to trade, bad environments, and on and on. I think Gaza has already collapsed. I don't think it's collapsing in 2020. I think it's already gone. What we have to do is figure out how we even pick up the pieces. And my biggest fear is when we give them all kinds of aid and help and all, that the powers that be will take it and just use it to fire missiles into Israel again. How do we get them to stop?
Okay, let's go back a second. To be clear, the U.S. does not give any aid to Gazans. Other international organizations, NGOs mainly do. And I can tell you for a fact that goes to the people of Gaza. Secondly, like I said before, I'm kind of messing with your whole framework here. I'm not saying a rocket firing from Gaza into Israel is right. All I'm saying is they're resisting their siege and their occupation, and under international law, they have a right to resist their occupiers. That being said, when you compare the two sides, one is like a dinosaur, primitive weapons, and the other is the fourth most powerful military in the world with nuclear weapons. So what the real issue is they are living under occupation, they are living under siege. No human being should live like that or be forced to live like that. When Israel controls 100% of everything that goes in and out of Gaza. I'm asking you to kind of readjust your whole framework here and think about this in a new light, because that's the threat from Gaza poses to Israel is basically non-existent. And Israeli people in high government have even admitted that. I'm asking you to read other sources and listen to other voices, because like here, I have these here, and I have a list there with all kinds of websites and everything, and Listen to Noam Chomsky, Ilan Pappé, Gideon Levy, Norman Finkelstein, Mikko Peled, he lives in San Diego now. He's Israeli. He's the son of a general, the general who led the 1967 war. I mean, he is so pro-Palestinian, and he's coming from the complete Zionist side, moving over to that. There's a difference between Judaism and Zionism, and we need to keep that in mind in our country. It often gets, those two things get conflated. Zionism is a nationalist movement. Judaism is a religion.
I guess what this shows me is how little information, not only on this issue, but it is just an example of many issues that the American public just never hears about. There is very little, when we watch what's going on with our election right now, there's so many, the same themes coming back that are being spread by the media, and but it's hard to get other information out to the American people. And thank you for bringing another viewpoint to us today.
Thank you. And from our what we saw, I like your other point. 2020 is a generous estimate.
Very good.
Thank you.
It is our tradition to give a token of appreciation to our speakers. This is a recording of the Des Moines Gay Men's Chorus.
Awesome. Thank you.
Well, that was eye-opening. But that means when you start the day off poorly, it means it can only get better as the day goes on. So be optimistic and have some hope that does not apparently exist in Gaza at this point. I took a couple of things from the remarks this morning. One was the Gaza syndrome that she described. I didn't think that I could take much more stress than I've been enduring with this election as it has progressed. And it helps some to find that someone else is even more miserable and under stress than I am, and that I have hope that it'll be over by next Wednesday, which they don't have. The other is the word that you gave me for catastrophe, Nakba. I've been looking for another word to describe the Republican candidate for president. And I'm able to take that from your remarks this morning. Thank you very much. Now, we do have a drawing for these tickets. Live Out Loud benefit for the project, and we have five tickets available. One is Jim Sterba, another is Nick Zavala, yeah. Another is Ryan Wiedner, that'll be convenient. Another is Bill Brown. 2, 3, 4. And the fifth is for Alan van der Linden. So, congratulations to all of you. And I have your tickets in my possession, so if you'll see me after breakfast, I can give you your ticket. And the other, we have four tickets to the ACLU of Iowa Bill of Rights brunch. One is Ryan Wiedner. One is Nick. That's going to be convenient again. Yeah. One is Bob Phelan. And one is Scott Kuknio. So, congratulations to those four. Those are two entities that are events that are being co-sponsored by FFBC as a result of a decision made by our board. I want to thank again all of you for being here today. I want to encourage you to vote if you haven't already. Vote twice if you get the opportunity. But we all are involved in politics, whether we like it or not, and we need to do our part by voting. I also want to invite you to join us again on December the 2nd for our next meeting. And our meeting next time will have as a speaker Mel Duncan. Mel Duncan is going to be a perfect fit with what we've just heard about this morning. He is a co-founder of the international organization Nonviolent Peace Force. It's headquartered in Brussels, and it also has an office in Minnesota, in Minneapolis. And they put together teams of people to go into places of conflict and provide refuge and support for non-combatants and work as much as they can to bring the two sides together and dialogue and reduce violence. It should be very interesting. They have people in Sudan, they have people in the Middle East, and a number of other hot spots around the world. And he is the co-founder of this organization and is going to be here as our speaker in December. And so I look forward to seeing you there, and thank you for being here this morning.